Welcome to our group on Who Am I Anyway? We're glad to see some familiar faces here and faithful followers and some new faces. Joe, my husband, is a clinical psychologist in Rockford, and I am Pat Vaughn, and I have a degree in education. Our sessions are workshop-oriented and directed at a journey into self with the hopes that we will be able to sing the Lord's song more confidently. Our first session on Monday was Who Am I in Relationship to Those I Don't Know? The second session, Who Am I in Relationship to Myself? And the third session today is on Who Am I in Relationship to Those Close to Me? Perhaps a spouse or boyfriend, girlfriend, someone that you, perhaps a significant figure in your life or person. Our focus today will be on irrational thinking, the negative talk, the negative thinking that gets in the way of our perceptions and causes misperceptions of the way we communicate to others, and specifically one close to us. Joe, you want to talk a little bit more on the irrational ideas?
Just want to say a word about self-talk and irrational thinking. When Pat and I were talking about how to set this particular session up, we thought that what we wanted to do was to kind of pull together some ideas, some irrational ideas, some irrational ways in which we think about relationships with other people. And that takes just maybe a little bit of an explanation about what is irrational thinking. I guess we all have an idea of what's rational and irrational, and that probably varies a little bit with all of us. But Albert Ellis is a psychologist who in 1961 developed a theoretical orientation that he called rational emotive psychotherapy. And that was based on the notion that a lot of what we do and a lot of the kinds of problems that we cause for ourselves in our relationships with other people and the way that we feel about ourselves is the result of, or are the result of, irrational thinking, negative self-talk. Ellis was somewhat avant-garde in that this thinking was somewhat contradictory to the more traditional and psychodynamic notions of the way in which people have problems. The more classical notion, the more Freudian notion, was that people have problems because of their emotional response, and that an event might occur, and that the person had an emotional response to that event, a traumatic response perhaps, or a fixated response, but nonetheless a strong emotional response. And that emotional response then created negative thinking, bad feelings, hang-ups, if you will. Ellis kind of reversed that, and what he said is that an event doesn't cause a problem at all for us. An event doesn't cause an emotion. Rather, what happens is that an event occurs and we interpret that event in a certain way, and we tell ourselves something. Sometimes it's almost, sometimes it is subliminal, sometimes it's very quick, sometimes it's not even fully conscious, but we tell ourselves something about that event, and that telling, that self-talk, is what gets us into trouble, because that self-talk then is what creates the feeling or the emotion. So that what he said was that it works something like this, that an event occurred, A, and that initiated a certain kind of interpretation, or let's call it what he does, self-talk, and then the feeling or the physical response, and there was some research that was done that showed that actually certain kinds of self-talk created certain kinds of stresses. If you were here last week, you heard me talk about the ways in which stress builds up in our life. Some of the research that's been done on Ellis's ideas and on self-talk and rational thinking said that, demonstrated that some of the physiological response of the body could be a stress response if the self-talk was negative. So that this was A, this was B, and this was C. And that what Ellis said was, and what the rational, emotive people say is that A doesn't cause C, B causes C. Okay? And so the focus then has to be on what is it that we tell ourselves that is irrational? I have to tell my favorite Ellis story because every time I start talking about Albert Ellis, I think of this story. I heard of it and I experienced it when I was in training as a psychologist. One of the things that we were doing was in the state hospital in which I was doing my internship was we were being trained in psychotherapy. We were listening to some of Ellis's tapes, and Ellis, on this first tape that we were listening to, was a very depressed man. And the man is talking in the beginning of the tape. This tape starts as the therapy hour, and he's talking about a number of setbacks he's had. His business is failing or not doing well. His marriage is not going well. He's feeling pretty bad about the fact that he's getting older. And you can almost hear this fellow just continue to get slower and more depressed as he's talking. And for the longest time, you listen to this tape, and Ellis hasn't said anything yet, and this guy is talking and talking, and about 10 minutes into the tape, Ellis says, and he has this very nasal voice, I'll never forget it, Ellis says, "You keep telling yourself this bullshit." And that's really essentially his theory, that a great part of what is happening when things are going wrong for us is that we are telling ourselves and living out certain kinds of negative ideas, negative tapes, as Pat said, that are contributing to a good part of our problem. Interestingly enough, on this particular tape then, all of a sudden this guy begins to kind of get a little bit brighter, you know, and Ellis keeps challenging then his thinking, keeps challenging and pointing out the ways in which his thinking is getting him into trouble and the ways in which it's irrational. So he does more in therapy than just curse at or use foul language with his clients. But I think that really captures it. And you might just think about that phrase every once in a while when you get yourself into that kind of pattern. But that gets us to what we wanted to do today, at least for the first part of the time, was talk about some ways in which irrational thinking works in our relationship with other people. Pat and I have come up with a number of irrational ideas, what we think are irrational ideas associated with or relative to relationships between people. I'd like to go through those with you. Pat's going to, we've got some copies for you, so let's pass those out. Pat's going to read or speak to the irrational idea, and then I'm going to try to respond with a kind of alternative, and hopefully a more rational, a more reasonable alternative.
Counseling at the University of Maine, and we did study different theorists, and one of them was Ellis, and we're supposed to kind of try to live the theory for a month or so. Because every time something happened, I tried to do self-talk and make it very positive. I remember this one week where the snow was deep, I couldn't get my snow car started. Finally got it started, I had a flat tire, and I kept self-talk as soon as it went. But just seriously, I bounced a check at the bank. Came home one evening and find the window been open and the pipes had frozen and I said, well, that's okay. Finally, I think on Friday that day, I was feeling very proud that I had been able to listen to the theory and be able to talk myself out of it. I picked up the phone to dial and the phone was dead. And I picked up the phone and I threw it right across the room, and I never felt so great in all my life.
Well, how can you do self-talk when the phone's dead anyway, right? that took action at that point.
But it seems to me that one of your rational ideas might have been that you have to be happy all the time. you were trying to talk yourself out of depression and anger. Maybe you had an irrational idea of thinking around that you were supposed to be happy all the time, and maybe you should have told yourself, it's okay that, you know, felt good.
It's my understanding Ellis is not trying to do away with feelings, but trying to do away with feelings that immobilize you.
Right.
So yeah. It's okay to be angry, but not so angry that, you know, you're not able to.
Yes, don't misunderstand. He doesn't say that feelings aren't important. What he's interested, though, is in the connection. And what he's interested in pointing out is that the event itself doesn't cause the feeling, that the interpretation of the event and what we tell ourselves about the event causes the feeling. Maybe, if we have time, we can go into some of the ways in which he talks about trying to combat negative feelings and or negative self-talk. And it isn't just trying to say positive things to yourself. He has some kind of rational steps and some homework kinds of assignments that he uses that he wants people to learn in terms of how they can analyze whether or not their thinking's irrational.
But well, that's why I imagine two people that experience the same event can see it so entirely opposite.
Sure.
Things.
Right. Our interpretation of things has a great deal to do with how we see it. Yeah. Two of the things that he says we do a lot, for example, in irrational thinking is we absolutize and we awfulize. And, you know, when we absolutize, we're using the words ought, should, must, always, never. You know, we're saying to ourselves, I ought to be able to always do this kind of thing. That's absolutizing. And awfulizing is when we kind of make catastrophic interpretations of situations that occur to us. So an example of awfulizing would be, you know, your wife is mad at you, and you read that as she doesn't love me anymore, okay? Or your friend is upset with you, and you read that as that person doesn't want to be your friend anymore, instead of reading it as your friend is upset with you, okay? And instead of, so we awfulize, we put it in the worst possible terms. I've got some mild chest pains, that means I'm going to have a heart attack, or I'm having a heart attack. That's awfulizing, okay? That's making, taking the situation and making the worst possible thing happen out of it. But let's go through these. We want to give you some time with this today too, but we want to get through these, so Pat and I are going to go kind of bounce these back and forth and let you kind of follow along with us, and then we'll have something planned for the second half of our time today. Pat?
Okay, the first irrational idea is the idea that it is necessary and possible that an individual be loved by everyone for everything he or she does.
Instead of the idea that it's impossible to please everybody, that no matter how much people care about us, and no matter what relationship we're in, that there are always going to be times when people are going to be upset with us. There are always going to be situations when our behavior, or our attitude, or our response is not going to be acceptable to somebody. This is a good example of absolutizing. An individual be loved by everyone for everything. That people always like what we do. That people always accept us. Impossible.
The idea.
Couldn't you just as well substitute anyone?
Where?
The idea that it's necessary and possible that an individual be loved by anyone for everything.
Sure.
Okay.
Sure.
Okay. Sure.
Yeah.
I think we.
That. Sure.
Further down, I think we've kind of hit that point too, but that's a good point. Okay. The second one, the idea that a person should control a relationship. And it is horrible if one does not have that control.
Again, a kind of awfulizing here. Actually, as most of us should know, or hopefully we ought to become aware of, that the more we try to control people, especially adults, the more likely it is that we're going to drive them away from us. I see this very clearly in a lot of families that I work with. I see it in my own family, too, as far as my children growing up. We can get away with a lot of control, and we can get away with a lot of domination, especially with our children, until they get a little bit older. But when they get into adolescence, or when they begin to develop their own perspective from a much more adult point of view, the more we try to control them, the more we try to tell them, this is the way you have to be, this is what you have to do, the more we're going to drive that person away. Part of the conflict that is in any family with any adolescent is learning how to let that person have some of that control, and ultimately, of course, all of that control for themselves. But that tension between parents and kids, parents used to or accustomed to perhaps maybe even over-controlling, learning how to back off and let that person become who they're going to become and let that person grow, is almost always a source of conflict in my office, in any office setting, psychology, counseling, a very common kind of problem.
Okay, 3, the idea that if one worked hard enough at it or made the best possible choice of partners, that one could have a perfect relationship.
Subscribers to this belief are almost, well, they are always disappointed. They're also characterized by moving from one relationship to another and continually disappointed. These are folks who are always looking for that perfect fit, and of course they're never going to find it. There's no such thing as a perfect relationship. No such thing as a situation in which conflict doesn't exist. No such thing as a friendship or a marriage or a close intimate relationship between two people that doesn't also have some problems, some conflicts, some rough spots, some rough times. But we still have this notion, again, here's an example of absolutizing, that somehow there must be a perfect way to have a relationship or a perfect relationship with someone else, and if I don't have it, then I've got to go around looking for it someplace else. The other part of that is that any time we get into a perfectionistic situation with ourselves or with other people, usually resentment and negative feelings about self come to the surface, simply because when we expect and when we have perfectionistic demands for other people or for ourselves, we're always disappointed. And when we're disappointed, we develop if we're disappointed in ourselves, it's a negative set that we develop about ourselves, or we become very critical of the other person.
Okay, 4. The idea that one needs someone other than oneself, or someone stronger or greater than oneself on whom to rely. And I must clarify this, we're talking about earthlings. We need God, and we just eliminated discussing our relationship with God in this here particular setting.
Yeah, and in this one, instead of the more rational idea would be, instead of understanding that that there's a trap in any situation where we feel we have to depend on, or where we're looking to depend on or allow someone else to take over for us. The trap in that is, the attraction, of course, is that we often think that it would feel very good to be in a situation where somebody else could do for us, or somebody else could protect us, or somebody else could take over for us. The trap is that it undermines any sense of our own competence, it undermines any sense or a full sense of our own independence, and ultimately undermines our self-concept. If we're not taking care of ourself, basically, and if we're not capable of that, and if we turn that over fully or turn that over primarily to somebody else, we're going to ultimately be unhappy.
5. The idea that in a relationship one can or should be primarily responsible for the happiness of another.
It's kind of the same thing, just from the other point of view, I guess. We can give to other people. We need to give to others in a relationship. We need to be concerned about the happiness of another person in a relationship. But that if we assume the responsibility for that happiness, we're living somebody else's life for them, and ultimately we're going to create feelings of resentment in ourselves, because we cannot really be totally focused on someone else's happiness, because almost always out of that comes a feeling of our own needs being shortchanged.
6. The idea that a relationship is only a good one when two people spend all their time together.
We all tire of one another. There isn't any relationship that that doesn't wear thin at times. There isn't any situation in which we don't need the refreshing kind of stimulation of other people, other contexts, or even alone time for ourselves. Doesn't mean that that person isn't extremely important to us. Doesn't mean that that we don't commit first and foremost to that person. But what it does mean is that we need other people too, and we need ourselves. We need our own alone time.
Number 7, the idea that in some point in a relationship, one no longer has to work at that relationship.
I see a number of couples in my practice, and one of the things that almost always has happened in a situation where marital counseling is in order or marital therapy is in order is that people have stopped working on the relationship, or perhaps they never thought that they had to, and the relationship was perhaps very good in the beginning but ultimately dissipated. Those of you who do counseling are probably very very aware of the number of times in which people who are living together for a period of time have an excellent relationship, and then they marry and they have terrible problems. A little bit of the same thing is often operating in that kind of situation. That in living together without the commitment of marriage, what has often happened is that these people are still, in a sense, dating and still relating in a way that is very positive and working on the relationship. Yet when marriage comes, too often our attitude is, okay, this is it, now I'm here, now I've arrived, life is just going to go on from here as far as the relationship's concerned. Nothing could be further from the truth, that we're growing constantly, and unless we pay attention to the growth in ourselves and that other person, they're going to leave us behind, or we're going to leave them behind, or we're going to grow in directions that pretty soon can't be bridged anymore.
8, the idea that if one person in a relationship tells the other person to go to hell, that they have a lousy relationship. Tell them how we pondered over that one.
Yeah, right.
We pondered over that one.
I don't know that telling somebody to go to hell was exactly the way to put that, but what we're trying to get at here is that that anger in a relationship is often cleansing for people. The important thing, and there's some books out on this for those, again, of you who might be interested, I think his name is George Bach. It's a book that's been out for a number of years now. It's called How to Fight Fair, I think, in Marriage. And there are a number of other books that talk about this basic approach, that there isn't anything wrong with anger. There isn't anything wrong with argument in marriage. As a matter of fact, it's probably, in any relationship, I slip into the marriage thing because Pat and I kind of work this out and talked a lot about our relationship and others, but in any relationship, there isn't anything wrong with conflict. There isn't anything wrong with saying, boy, I'm mad as heck about this situation, and I'm upset with you for what you did or for what happened. The important thing to keep in mind is that the anger doesn't become destructive to the self's esteem in a sense of the other person. When Pat and I were first married, we lived upstairs from a couple who had 5 children and who had the most horrendous fights that you would ever want to hear. And they taught us words that we didn't know. We didn't need to know those words anyway, but they taught them to us. They came up through the vents and the pipes, and they would humiliate each other. They would have just terrible arguments, and they would humiliate each other and abuse each other emotionally in a way that was just terribly destructive. That kind of fighting isn't healthy for anybody. But the kind of fighting that gets out our frustrations, that kind of dumps the anger out and says, okay, look, we got to deal with this, is very crucial to any kind of relationship. Because the more we tend to dump that down and press that down and keep it down, the more likely it is going to come out again in an indirect way. It's what we call passive-aggressive behavior. So that instead of being angry and really telling somebody how mad you are at them, you're 15 minutes for the next time, late for the next appointment that you're supposed to have with them, or you just happen to burn the bread, you know, or other kinds of things begin to happen in a relationship that are under the table that cause lots and lots of difficulties. And what's really operating there is anger. And if that anger doesn't get dealt with, if that anger doesn't get out in some way and get out of the table, it causes problems.
Okay, 9. The idea that there are innate behavioral and attitudinal differences between men and women, and that these cause most male-female relationship problems.
Instead of the idea that these differences, if they exist at all, are primarily learned or environmental, and that they can be relearned or that they can be negotiated, you know, that there aren't any set of expectations that any one person has to conform to just because they're male or just because they're female. Our society probably is loosening up in that way now, especially younger people. Pat and I continually are surprised, for example, as we walk along and are in communities and situations and see fathers taking care of kids. As recent as, and it doesn't sound very recent now when we say it, we were married 17 years ago, but as recent as 17 years ago when we had, 16 years ago when we had our first child, it wasn't nearly as common. Just wasn't nearly as common. Although I did some of that, I don't think I certainly did the I don't have the kind of involvement with our first daughter that that I see happening now with people where dads are carrying kids around on their backs and walking them down the street in strollers and moms are doing other kinds of things society has changed a great deal.
Number 10, the idea that all feelings of loneliness and unhappiness will be cured by a successful relationship.
This is kind of my personal belief, but other philosophers and people have shared it too. I believe that a kind of loneliness and a search for fulfillment is very much a part of being human. And that search for fulfillment has a lot to do with our spiritual life. And that we are, in a sense, never fully satisfied or never made fully related in a relationship with anybody. And we have to accept that, I think. We have to accept that that relationships are not going to solve all of our problems of inner tension, inner loneliness, and an inner need. I see this a lot with single people who either have never had a significant, close, personal, intimate relationship with another person, or who have had that relationship perhaps and then may have divorced or separated and are looking again for it. The expectation is sometimes very, very unrealistic that once I find that person, then everything's going to be okay. And I'm not going to feel this inner ache that I have. And they're often then very disappointed because it's awfully hard to fulfill that in a relationship.
And I don't think anyone in this room could really say that they've never felt that element of loneliness at some point in their life. Perhaps some of the married people, you just feel that even if you're married. There are times you just feel just lonely and you just need... You have to become comfortable with that loneliness and silence, and it's okay. It's okay to feel lonely. You know what I'm saying? Okay. Number 11, the idea that a relationship can grow without sharing between partners.
And this really goes back to the earlier one, too, where we talked about... working at the relationship, the sharing between partners and the talking about who we are stops in relationships that are not working well. Those relationships oftentimes continue. Many of us perhaps are in a relationship like that or had parents who we observed in a relationship where there was very little talking, very little sharing. Those relationships can and do stay together, but they are often not very fulfilling relationships. That unless we are keeping in touch with one another, we grow away from, we grow in different directions, we grow faster and slower, and it is extremely important to have some kind of communication between ourselves and another person. One of the things that I often do in working with couples is that I require that they set up a time where they just talk with one another. And you'd be surprised how many people don't talk to one another except about very basic, mundane kinds of things. What they're going to have for dinner, maybe a little bit about what the schedule is at work, and then the rest of the evening is watching television or doing something else, but not communicating. That is not good, not healthy in a relationship. And the relationship does not grow unless we were able to share those things.
I was at an educator's workshop, and we were told that the time that a parent spends with his child is 14 minutes.
Yes.
And of that time, all but 3 minutes is in a negative. You didn't clean up your room, you didn't do this. So just 3 minutes was for a positive tone.
Mm-hmm. There have been also some studies of couples which with equally distressing numbers as far as the amount of time spent in open communication or caring kind of communication. It's often very, very minimal.
Yeah, I think that sometimes it's important to set up times to do positive, just mindless activity, so to speak, as well as it is to do the negative. I've often found in families, especially like chronically mentally ill, that most of their family relationships have been so negative. The children don't want to come and visit the parents anymore. They don't want to have anything to do with each other. And even for normal people, I find that in counseling situations, if you're involved in like a couple counseling, you go to see the counselor and it's really heavy session, you talk about something, then it's fun to just go to the zoo or something for a while. You know, you work, tell us, have fun together, and enjoy each other. Not that easy, usually after a heavy session, but you know, sometimes it's good to just have some positive memories, mm-hmm. as well as to work hard.
Yeah, it's not to say that every minute of the day has to be spent discussing the relationship. That can be terribly distressing in itself. And that's just a lot of hard work, and nobody wants to do that. But too often the other is the problem, that we don't spend enough time talking about the relationship. We don't spend enough time telling that other person where we are, what we need, what happened to us.
Okay. And the sharing, you know, both Joe and I really would probably stress this as being crucial to relationship, because the sharing is going to help alleviate some of that loneliness. But take, for example, perhaps maybe you lose your mother, that lonely feeling is still going to be there. But if you're sharing, you're going to alleviate some of the other lonelinesses that exist in a marriage. Okay, or in a relationship. Okay, 12. The idea that we can have an intimate relationship with another person without revealing our fears, vulnerabilities, and weaknesses.
That's, again, a kind of an extension, I think. It's a little bit different in that it's easy sometimes to talk about the good things that happen to us. It's a lot more difficult to talk about the things that hurt, the things that don't go well, the things that we're afraid of, the things that that make us vulnerable, and yet unless we can risk that in a relationship with another person, we often again are shortchanged in terms of the depth of that relationship, in terms of the intimacy of that relationship. Unless we can begin to try to say who we are and what we're afraid of, not just what we feel good about, but what we do well, we get shortchanged on the intimacy aspect of the relationship.
13, the idea that a relationship once hurt can never be healed.
Again, referring to my work with other people in psychotherapy and counseling, I've seen many instances where a hurt relationship, a relationship that has been ripped open, is in a sense strengthened by that difficulty. And I guess I always think about, out of brokenness comes wholeness. And I think that's true for relationships too. I don't think you have to have a problem in your relationship to make it better. There are lots and lots of people who go through life in a very positive relationship with a friend or with someone else without ever running into a serious problem. But there are lots of other situations where that happens in a relationship. It sometimes helps if especially if couples, as a result of that conflict or that hurt, can hang in there and work with that and deal with that. It sometimes does strengthen the relationship. It opens up possibilities for the relationship that weren't there before. It opens up communication in the relationship. And it also opens up, it forces the relationship into a different framework. That especially if the hurt has been very severe, if there's been a serious problem in the marriage, or in the relationship between two people, there isn't any way the relationship could continue in the way that it was. And as a result, the individuals are forced into finding a different way to relate. If they can find that different way, and if they can build on that, many times the relationship can become stronger and establish a more solid ground.
14. The idea that a healthy relationship exists when one person is usually giving and the other person is usually taking, listening, talking, acting, or reacting.
There are these kinds of one-sided relationships. You may be aware of some where there seems to be one dominant, one submissive, one talker, one non-talker, one orderer and one orderee. Those kinds of relationships do work. But they're tenuous in some ways, in the sense that there is always the risk that when you are working in a polarity, that certain kinds of resentment and certain kinds of frustrations occur as a part of that forced or as a part of that polar position. That if you always are the one who is taking responsibility for making decisions in a relationship, that's a pretty heavy kind of burden that can eventually cause a good deal of frustration and resentment. If you're always the person who has to wait for somebody else to make the decision, even though, again, we sometimes choose those roles because they feel safer to us, it also can create a good deal of resentment for us.
15, the idea that in a good relationship there is no need for other relationships or other interpersonal contacts.
It's important that we have, here again I'd be speaking primarily about a marriage relationship or a close intimate relationship between two people. It's important that we have that connection of closeness between ourselves and another person, but it's important too that we not make it totally exclusive, and that's sometimes a difficult fence to straddle. I'm reminded of a young couple that I work with, that I'm working with now, as a matter of fact, a young professional man and his wife, who is also a professional person, both. Pretty solid with one another, but one of them much more in need of a great deal of attention from the other person. Because of the other person's career, they don't get as much as they want. As a result, this person then has gone out and found somebody else, not in an illicit relationship, not in a sexual relationship at this point, but a person who listens to and talks with and is involved with this person. That's, for that person, that's a very dangerous situation. It's dangerous because if we move the primary focus of our relationship, if we have a close relationship with somebody, a marriage situation, for example, and if most of the needs do not get met within that marriage dyad, and too many begin to get met in relationships outside of the outside of that dyad, then the likelihood is that we're going to have difficulty, or those persons are going to have difficulty. At the same time, we need the freedom in a relationship to be able to relate to somebody else, to be able to meet other people, to be able to have friends outside of the marriage or outside of that primary relationship, to be able to refresh ourselves in contact with many other different kinds of people. But the central relationship has to remain intact. As I said, working that out is something that we all do individually in a relationship, but it's an extremely important part of that process.
Dividing groups.
I think what we'd like to do now is take a few minutes and let you talk about these. We'd like you to divide up into three, maybe four groups. Let's have a group in the balcony. Let's have one group here, one group here, and one group here. Well, let's have four groups down here. This is a big group.
Yes, large.
Let's have this. Let's just have, just turn your chairs around and talk to one another for a moment. And some of you group over here, and some of you group over here, and some of you group over here. I'd like you to take a look at these and also see if you can come up with any other irrational ideas about relationships with other people that might have meaning to you.